In my self-hosting journeys, I have decided to self-host a links in bio page on my website.
I don't think you have you?
Have I not?
Because links in bio is the link is in my biography for this application we're on. I think you meant I am hosting my own see my link tree, I think is what you're hosting.
Is that it? Okay.
That's what it is, yeah.
I'm just going off those bright young things on Instagram that usually say link in bio or something when they post something clever on Instagram. And I thought that's what I've made.
Okay, granddad.
I do feel a bit like granddad at this moment. The application that I'm using, I say application, it's not an application, we'll get to that in a moment, is a Linktree-like page, basically, is what it's all about. And I created this because as I explore my activity pub options, it occurred to me that what I want is actually a page like this where I can say, these are all of the places you can find me. Because some of the services that I'm looking at using only give you one place to say, this is my website or whatever. And just sending people to my blog doesn't feel like the right place to go. So I thought one of these Linktree type services would be a good idea, but I didn't want to use a service. I wanted to do it myself. So I found this project called Little Link.
So for the smart people like me and you that know what Linktree is, it's basically a single page list of links that you can send people to with a memorable domain. Have you got a memorable URL to this handy dandy cut out and keep reference guide to where you can find Martin everywhere online?
As if by magic, a new domain appears, and it is wimpysworld.link.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's just a quick URL, and as you say, it's a list of all of the places that people can connect with you online. So your social media accounts, your GitForge account links, the video platforms you're on, and in my case, one of the customizations I've made is underneath all of my personal links, I've made a whole section about Linux Matters and all of the places you can find Linux Matters and also subscribe to the podcast, because that is one of the places where I and the two of you exist.
So this is a web page with some links on, which...
It's a web ring.
I've seen this before. So what does Little Link actually do? Is there some sort of like back-end application here where you put your icons and your URLs and it makes this page? Or what's Little Link actually giving you as opposed to just crafting this yourself with HTML?
Little Link is the simplest thing ever. It is a single static HTML page and some CSS classes, so that as you create the links to, for example, Mastodon, one of the CSS class examples is a Mastodon branded button. So as you create the links to the different platforms that you're on, each of those buttons is branded appropriately for those different sites. So it all looks very attractive with the right icons and the right color schemes on each of the buttons. So it's very clear, like, which place you're advertising.
So you are actually just making an HTML page with a list of links, and then Little Link is making it look nice.
You don't even have to make it. So the Little Link project, the way that it works is you simply fork the project, and then the index.html file has every possible link in there, and you just uncomment the ones you want to use and replace the link to the place you want to be. Now, as it happens, there's also a community project called Little Link Extended, which is a bunch of additional CSS classes for loads of other places. And I've added that to mine because that had things like Mastodon in it, which obviously I care about. But what's interesting about this is whilst I'm self-hosting, and I'll get to how I'm doing the deployment in just a moment, on the Little Link project, there's a couple of buttons, and you can just click Deploy with Vercel or Deploy with Netlify, and it bounces you through this wizard that automatically forks the project for you into your own GitHub account, does the OAuth and connects you to the free plan on both those services and automatically hooks up instantaneous deployment to those platforms. So if you don't have your own web hosting, it will automatically set up free hosting to automatically deploy this as you change it.
And presumably it could also deploy it to GitHub pages if it's just a static page.
It could also do that. I don't remember if that's one of the options. It may well be. I remember that I think I started with Vercel to try it out, and then I set it up going to my own site. So even for a CSS numpty like me, it was really easy to add the extra CSS file for Little Link Extended, which adds hundreds of more branded sites. And if you have somewhere you want to link people, which isn't in there, it's very trivial to just go in and add a new CSS class for your custom stuff. So I've added one for my GoTo Social, for example, which is using the sloth icon and all of that sort of stuff. And I'm self-hosting, so I found a project in the GitHub Action Marketplace, which I think is worth highlighting as well. It's called SSH Deploy, and I've used similar tools in the past, but this is sort of an all-in-one, one-stop shop for how to provide your key, your SSH key, as a secret in a GitHub Action and automatically have the site deployed to your own server using rsync. And it's all in one action, and there's a few configuration stanzas, and it handles the whole, you've made a change, I'll automatically deploy that to your self-hosted instance using rsync. And it's the best of these types of tools that I've encountered recently.
I should take a look at that, because I homegrew a solution in a GitHub Action for my popey.com/blog some time ago on GitHub, and it works, so it's like fine, but it's a little bit janky. I wrote a blog post about it. Maybe we'll put a link in the show notes, but this would be cleaner and tidier. I just need to set aside time, among other things, to do that.
Yeah, and I did actually start with looking at your blog post and copied what you'd done, and I thought, okay, there was a few extra steps in there, and then I found this thing that kind of rolls it up it all into one simple little bundle.
Nice.
So yes, I think that this is SSH Deploy is a really nice tool. So if you are looking to, you know, advertise your presence on that there Fediverse and other platforms, this is a great little tool. It's really easy to get started, and it looks very attractive and pretty, very simple to customize.
I have been logging in remotely, 2024 style.
SSH? Getting your 18-year-old son to go and press a button for you. Remote hands? No? Something else?
Yelling across the house, the commands I need typed in, yes. I've got this box under my desk, which is like a headless desktop, which was previously my Steam box before I got a Steam Deck. And now it primarily serves for video encoding, which I occasionally need. The way that I do that is I give it a kick to turn it on, and then I log in from a laptop remotely, and either via SSH or more often than not through the desktop to configure whatever job I need and set it going, and then disconnect and leave it running until it's finished. And in the past, I managed all of this using X2Go, which is a brilliant remote application and desktop graphical login thing.
Yeah, X2Go is quite great. And in fact, a little known fact is the X2Go Hackfest in Germany was where Ubuntu Mate started in earnest. And I met the Debian developers that sponsored my work and what have you.
Can I just rewind slightly as to, you said you were very hand-wavy about some video encoding jobs, and any normal nerd would tell you you SSH into the box on an FFmpeg, but I suspect you're probably running, I don't know, Make MKV and Handbrake and stuff, graphical desktop applications?
Exactly, yes. Ah. And I've also got my auto Handbrake wizard, which will display a GUI if it's run on the desktop, for doing like batch jobs and stuff like that. So it can be handy to have the desktop for that.
Sorry, I can't hear batch jobs without thinking of Martin in the last episode and mainframes. So now I'm thinking you've got AS400 under your desk, and that is fact. Now that's canon.
Anyway, there was a point to all of this somewhere, and I'm trying to find my way back to it. yeah, so basically, in the brave new world of Wayland, X2Go doesn't do the job so well anymore.
Yeah, there's a clue in the name there, isn't there?
Yes, it is. X2Go is very reliant on their X11 client server model.
X2Go has X2Gone.
Yes.
Oh, no.
All right, sorry.
And network transparency, which apparently we're told we don't actually want anymore.
Oh, okay.
So I needed a new way of handling this remote login, And I just upgraded the machine to Ubuntu 24.04 LTS, which actually, thanks to, I believe it's GNOME 46, has an excellent new remote login solution.
Oh,
right.
So if you go into the settings app and go to system, there's now a remote login option, which gives you two options. It gives you desktop sharing and remote login. So desktop sharing will allow you to give someone access to your current desktop, either to view or to control. And the remote login, you set up a user and you connect via an RDP client, and it will actually drop you remotely into GDM, where you can log in as any user that doesn't currently have an active session.
Oh, wow. That's really quite smart.
Yes. So you can either connect as a user who has a session running, or you can connect in as one who isn't. And you can also, I think, log in as a user whose session is already running and kick them off their existing session, which is, yeah, I'm sure there's a use case for that, but might be a bit unkind.
So based on your description there, am I right in saying that this is quite a tightly coupled solution that's sort of integrated into GNOME itself?
I believe so. So I went looking in the Ubuntu release notes and didn't see this mentioned, but then I went looking in the GNOME release notes and I saw it mentioned there. So I think it is a GNOME feature. I have in the past played around doing this with XRDP, which can do the same thing. But when you log into that, the login manager you get is some real, you know, Windows 95 styled nonsense. And it's not an easy configuration experience and not a pretty experience. Whereas this is slick, very easy to configure and looks beautiful.
How does it handle differing resolutions? Because if I'm sat on my Ubuntu Asahi 13-inch MacBook Air running Ubuntu, and remote into my ThinkPad Z13 in the office that's got an LG monster monitor connected to it, what's going to happen there?
So it does actually explain quite clearly in the configuration in the two tabs. So it does something different depending if you're logging into an active session or not. So if you're logging into an active session, you get the resolution that that session is running at.
Right.
So if you're in a window that's smaller than your LG funny shaped monitor, you'll be scrolling around. But if you're logging in to a new session, the resolution is set by your window that you're running it in.
This is glorious. I can think of plenty of activities I would need this for.
Yes.
So actually creating like a separate user account, which is your remote account, would be a smart way to go here. So you always negotiate like a remote friendly resolution as you connect.
I guess if you're not logged in on the machine, if the machine is just for remote GUI, you know, like a Citrix server kind of thing.
Yeah. So the way that this machine is set up to run is you boot it and it logs in as the Steam user and launches Steam in big picture mode. And then that's there for me to connect via Steam Link or stream a game to my Steam Deck or whatever if I want to. But then there's another user which is there just for doing things like video encoding or, I don't know, whatever else I want to do on a GPU.
I've been learning Django by fire.
It's the only way.
Yes, apparently it is the only way. The way you do this is by getting somebody else's project and try and fathom what on earth is going on without reading any documentation, but just pressing buttons and deleting and moving things around and trying things until you understand it. That's my way. Anyway, so I've been noodling with a piece of software called Savannah. I don't think I've mentioned it on the show before. It's a community relationship manager written in Python and Django. It's open source. There is a hosted version that you can pay for in order to help pay for development of the thing. And there's also the source code on GitHub that you can clone and deploy yourself or just run on your workstation. And it's like a CRM system. So I said community relationship manager. It's like a customer relationship manager. So it has some of the same terminology, but it's for tracking community contributions. It's not for tracking like sales leads and targets for sales and marketing people, although there is a little bit of that potentially in there. It's more to do with keeping an eye on your community health. So You know, are people's pull requests being attended to? Are questions being answered? Are issues being resolved? That kind of stuff. And how many members are there in the community? And what level are they through the life cycle? Are they just someone who's filed an issue, or are they a core contributor or somewhere in between? That kind of stuff. So that's what the core mechanic of this application is. It's a website that you can deploy. It was written over a period of time by Michael Hall, mhall119. You may remember him from Canonical and Ubuntu back in the day. He now works at Arm. And he started it as a bunch of Python scripts that he used at Canonical to measure the activity in the Ubuntu community. And then every job he's had after Canonical, he's built on it and built on it and built on it. And now it's a big thing that is something that you can either pay him to host and use or deploy yourself somewhere. And I use it, and I've started getting involved in developing and maintaining it. So far, I haven't committed any patches. I've been doing this all locally because it's a bit of a new thing to me, and I'm a bit scared of doing it wrong. But I gave a couple of talks. I talked to OddCamp about it, and I also gave a talk last weekend at BarCamp London, the same talk, effectively. And it went down quite well. People seemed quite keen, but I need to solve a few problems. It's a bit sharp around the edges.
You were also good enough to set up an instance for the QuickEmu project. And in addition to some of the things you've identified there, one of the things that came out of it for me is that it actually identified hot issues that I wasn't aware were actually hot issues within the community, because you can see how much conversation there is around either a particular issue in GitHub, or in this case, a discussion in GitHub discussions around a particular support issue, which was a Fedora support for the packaging and what have you. So it's insightful in many different ways, as well as identifying like who your standout contributors are.
Yeah, it's got a lot in there. I'm not even scratching the surface of what it can do. It can connect to lots of different services. So the basic premise is it has a bunch of sources, as in Savannah has plugins to connect to other things like GitHub, GitLab, Discord, Discourse. It can connect to RSS feeds. And there's also an API, so you can create your own plugins to connect to other things and feed data into it. And the kind of things you're feeding into it are data about contributions people are making to your project and conversations people are having about and around your project. So those are the two parts. It's conversations and contributions. And I apologize to anyone who has seen this at OddCamp and BarCamp. I'm not going to redo the whole slides and everything here. But what I wanted to talk about was my experience with playing with this thing. And I kind of went on a bum steer initially, because I cloned the project and I could not get it running. And it turns out that there's something I've learned and I haven't internalized fully about people who use GitHub. And that is, some people work on a branch that isn't main. And so I cloned the main branch and I was like, I could not get this working. And it turns out I bumped into Michael out in Raleigh in North Carolina a few weeks ago, and I had a chat to him about it, and he said, oh yeah, it does work, I just deploy from the production branch. And I was like, oh right. And that's the one that's more up to date. But even then I couldn't get that working because there were problems with Python dependencies, problems with some of the modules that are now orphaned, because Michael's deployed it a while ago and it's running, and he's kind of left it alone and not touched it because it is just still running and it does run. He sometimes has to poke a job or something here and there to wake it up or get rid of some log files or something, but it mostly just works. And so I have been doing things like updating the Python requirements.txt to update all the dependencies. And I hope everyone is sitting down right now. And if you're driving, I would urge you to pull over to the side of the road. I have made a Docker file.
Who are you and what have you done with Alan?
I know, right? I'm a changed man. I thought I can do virtual ems. I use UV for doing virtual ems with Python. I love UV. It's fantastic. But I thought, you know what? This is a candidate for making it easier in a quick and easy way with a Docker container that people can just, Docker build, and they've got a container that they can test on their local machine or deploy somewhere. And so I've made and prototyped and worked on this in my spare time such that you can either use SQLite, or you can configure it to use Postgres or MySQL, MariaDB. And I've put all the options in there with all the environment set up. And it's all basic stuff that probably anyone could do, but it's not all there already. And so I just wanted to add this to make the on-ramp to people contributing to or having a play with it a little bit easier. Now, as we record this, I haven't finished all of this, but I have deployed it a few times using this Docker build, and it works fine. There are a few nuances that I need to iron out, but in order to just run it on your workstation, it is going to be possible once I commit this, and I'll put a link in the show notes. So that will give me a target to get this done by the time this comes out. And then you'll be able to deploy it yourself and try it out. All you need, if you're going to connect it to GitHub, is a API key for GitHub. And if you want to connect it to Discourse, you just need an API key there. There are other things you can connect it to that don't need API keys, like RSS feeds and so on. But I found it super useful from a user point of view of the tool, Savannah, to see, as Martin said, like what's going on in the community and identifying new people or people whose activity has dropped off. You know, maybe they're on holiday, maybe they're sick of the project, who knows? But also it tells you, like, gives you little notifications when people come back, like so-and-so has been away for 3 weeks, and then it gives you a notification, so-and-so is back at the project. Little things like that that you might not recognize, like in amongst all the other data that is in GitHub. A lot of this you could just get from GitHub, but the fact that this correlates GitHub and Discourse and Discord all together gives you a real, as it says on the marketing blurb on the website, a holistic view of the community. And that's what I really like about it. And then from a developer point of view, being able to noodle around with it, the code base is actually not that hard for me to understand. And I am not an expert in this. And I can figure out a lot of what's going on. And I've even written a patch that removes Twitter support because it can use the Twitter API, but it can't anymore because Elon. And so I've made a patch, whether Michael will accept it or not, I don't know, but I've made a patch that removes the Twitter dependencies, and that fixes part of the build. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of little things. Some of it is adding, some of it's removing, as with all code changes. And I'm quite enjoying it. It's quite a fun project to work on, and I'm really hoping I can spur some more people on to play with it.
It sounds like there's a lot of stuff that this does, which you're finding useful. Is there anything that, from your sort of experience doing community management, is there a feature it doesn't have which you're thinking, oh, I might like to add that?
I can give you three examples. More plugins is one of them. So, for example, it doesn't have a plugin for Blue Sky, doesn't have a plugin for Mastodon, but I wrote one for Mastodon. And so I wrote the code that goes and gets, accesses your Mastodon instance server, and then pulls the data about who's liking or who's resharing your toot. Now, I know this is controversial, and some people on Mastodon don't like their data leaving Mastodon. So I haven't published this, and I haven't thought how I would publish this and how you articulate what you're doing here, because I know this is a very delicate thing to do on Mastodon, less so on other platforms like Blue Sky. But I found it actually surprisingly easy. The API for stuffing data into Savannah is not hard to understand at all. There's very few API calls. It's just basically you're creating a new member of the community, you're adding a contribution, or you're adding a conversation. That's basically the three API calls you need. And creating a new member is someone who's interacted with you. Creating a new contribution is, you know, someone added or removed some code. And adding a conversation is someone replied to an issue or something like that. It's actually not hard to grok how it all fits together. The two other things I'll briefly mention that are missing: proper sentiment analysis to determine how people are feeling. It can look for keywords like thanks and that someone's grateful and stuff like that, but detecting whether people are happy or sad in the project, I don't think it does that yet particularly well. And the other thing that someone asked at Barcamp was, can it compare two projects? So the question someone asked is, can I point this at my competitor's Git repo? And the answer is yes. So long as they're public, if you're pointing at an open source project, yes, you can. But those are seen as two separate communities.
Yes.
Really, the way you would set it up. And so comparing them is a bit tricky. But you could potentially yoink the data out and do something with it. Or someone could write a plugin that does a compare these two communities or something. I don't know. But yeah, it's fun. I'm enjoying it. And it's really nice to have like a chunky project that's got a lot of sharp edges that I'm trying to rough down and make it a little bit smoother for people.
Yeah, it sounds like you've found an interesting way to get your teeth into Python in a bit more deeper way.
Mm.
And also in a way that's beneficial to, you know, what you do.
Yeah, and potentially beneficial to other people as well if they start Indeed. Using it. So, and maybe beneficial to Michael as well, because I'm promoting the tool and hoping that, you know, more people pay for the paid service so that he's got more incentive to, you know, maintain it. We just wanted to take a moment to say a heartfelt thank you to all the feedback that we've received electronically in email, Telegram, Discord, and in person. We've all had occasions this year where listeners have approached us and let us know how much they enjoy the show, that they learn new things, or just like the vibes. Thank you. That makes our whole effort very worthwhile. Also, if you're a Patreon supporter or share our podcast with friends, we appreciate you too. Thanks for listening to Linux Matters in 2024. We hope you continue subscribing after the holidays for more episodes in the new year.